Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 373 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 27th of April, 2018, as I record this. So today I have an interview with Joel Friedlander from thebookdesigner.com on how to produce a premium journal. And I really enjoyed this interview, and I always realise how little I know about the print side of things, and I learn a lot from Joel. And many of you will know that I did look into doing a creative pen journal and then backed away when I hit a load of complications, which we will talk about in the show, and all the surprising things that make a journal more expensive. So we'll be talking all about that. And fascinating, if you're interested in producing print-only products and or gorgeous journals, or just interested in learning more about the print side. And also, I was doing some research on journals and how I could do it without going through a specialist designer, and found this place, bookblock.com, and has loads of ways to customize your own. So interesting if you are a journaler or if you're considering this type of project. Okay, so in publishing news, I wanted to talk a bit about Netflix today, which I think is definitely tangential to publishing. And I think it's fascinating what's happening with Netflix versus Facebook. So much of Facebook's problems are stemming from the fact that they rely on an ad model, whereas Netflix model is subscription, and they don't have to tell anyone what they're doing. And it's very interesting. There's been a few news items this week talking about what's happening with Netflix. So first of all, their global subscriptions have hit 125 million monthly subscribers, of which I am one. And in the next month or so, more than half of these viewers will be outside the US. And this is really interesting because it's starting to change their programming, and they're moving into filming a lot more in other countries and in other languages other than English. So I think this is brilliant. And this global focus is really demonstrable for us because they are just not seeing any territorial issues here. When they make their own content, and I found the numbers are $8 billion on content this year, including 700 original TV shows and 80 movies. So basically they are, you know, when they make their own IP, their own intellectual property assets, they can just release them all over the world at the same time to their 125 million. And many of us will watch them. And this is a completely different view to many of the siloed country specific creative, you know, places, whether it's publishing or film or TV. And of course, it's very important that there are always these local, you know, exciting things going on. But as business people and creatives in a global world where streaming over the internet, whether that is subscription model for Netflix or, you know, mobile payments, as I talked about last time, or, you know, buying ebooks, this is the type of world we're living in. We're not constrained by physical location, which is why I'm so excited, continue to be so excited about our business model. Also interesting was that Netflix films were booed at Cannes Film Festival, and they are now not eligible for prizes because the films are not shown in cinemas first. And Netflix have said, well, you know, whatever, we will skip Cannes entirely. But Digital Trends have reports that there are rumours of Netflix buying movie theatres. And that's fascinating to me because, again, sort of the lesson for us is don't moan about not being allowed into various things. Just get on with doing it your own way and then reverse engineer. Like Netflix buying movie theatres is, I think it's hilarious because they'll basically go, okay, now we're releasing in movie theatres, even though they will release on streaming at the same time. So is this similar to Amazon buying bookstores, perhaps? You know, a way to bridge the gap between, you know, one business model and another business model. Some people were saying the industry fears for the future of a business model and an art form, which I think is total hyperbole, because this means more of the art form. There are actually more people making films, writing books, taking photos, you know, more art being created than ever before. What this is disrupting is the current status quo of the money being tied up in certain production companies, certain publishers, that type of thing. And there are also plenty of people who love film and love cinema and want to watch it in groups. I am not one of those people. I haven't been to a cinema in a long time. I don't like crowds, I don't like noise, and I it's very overwhelming. So I'm very happy to trade a big screen for home viewing. I'm an ideal customer. And of course, many people, it's a big trip to go to a cinema. So I think that this will not kill the art form at all. As we have seen, digital does not kill print, but what it does do is create new opportunities and redistribute what's going on. Also, what's interesting is the realization as the demographic shifts are really, I think, becoming much more obvious now. As you know, the millennials are the biggest living generation, but also we're seeing the younger, younger people coming up. I don't know what the next, is it Generation Z or something? I'm not sure what the next generation after the millennials is, but you know, this growing population who have possibly never even watched mainstream TV or just, you know, prefer to consume on streaming services like Netflix, Hulu, Prime, YouTube, of course, Disney and Apple starting their own, expanding their own. So really fascinating as to things changing. And we talked last week about possibilities of selling direct and subscription models for authors in future. So really interesting changes. And Mark Williams on the New Publishing Standard reports on this too, and notes that this global approach is open to publishers if they would only get over the territorial split that has dominated publishing for so long and truly embrace digital, which doesn't involve shipping physical product around the world. So again, circling right back, this is where indies can really take advantage of a changing world. And the disruption means obviously bad times for some people, good times for other people. That is the way of change. But we can take advantage of this. And yes, I know my soapbox has been a global focus for years. But as I've said before, you know, we have barely started in this rise of, you know, the global digital mobile revolution, which is very much tied to demographic shift. And, so we really are, things really are changing. So an action step for you, okay, this is my challenge. Go back. Okay, so if you've been publishing for 2 years or more, look at your revenue split from outside of the US. Now, of course, so many people focus on advertising only to the US. It really skews your figures. But go and have a look at revenue outside of the US, especially if you are wide, if you are on Kobo, Apple, Draft Digital, Smashwords, all those other distributors. Have a look at how much revenue you made outside of the US 2 years ago, and then look at it now. And I think that even without any money spent on advertising in global markets, you will have grown your international income. Now, it might be small, but you know, as with Netflix, what's happening is streaming internet starts to expand into these other markets. We are going to reach more people. So as ever, exciting times ahead. I continue to just be giddy around international growth. It's fascinating to me. Okay, so apart from being giddy, I have been giddy this week also because I have finished my edits, my proofreader got the proofreading back, and I fixed all the little bits and bobs. And now I'm prepping how to write nonfiction for print formatting and also audiobook recording. So there are things that you do for print, you know, you changing some of the formatting, changing some of the links, removing the links and changing the URLs. And then for audiobooks, you really need to remove URLs and, you know, just have a link to a download with the resources, and also things like bullet points. If you have long lists of bullet points, they often don't come across well in audio. So I'm just going through and checking for audio as well this week. And then that will carry on. I've also been preparing my slides and my material to start recording the course on how to write nonfiction. So I will not be recording the audiobook, but I will be performing the course. or delivering the course. So if you would like me doing it, then that is the way to go. Hopefully everything will be ready end of May. But of course, always hard to know with the audiobook, because it, you know, you can't really control the timing on that. So we will see. But anyway, the pre-order is up for How to Write Nonfiction in all the usual places. So thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments on the week. I'm really glad you enjoyed my solo episode on London Book Fair. A number of you said that it was pretty intense and that you were tired just from listening. Well, you know, I aim to pack it all in and give you a glimpse of what it feels like to actually be at the London Book Fair. So I'm glad you enjoyed it, and really, really happy that that's done for another year. But what's, you know, what's so interesting, I was talking to Orna Ross on the Alliance of Independent Authors. We do a podcast there every month, and we were talking about this and how things change, and, you know, really just how interesting it's been to see the development of indie authors across the book fairs every year. And, you know, a couple of years ago, we had the American indies came over, Hugh Howey, Bella Andre, Barbara Freethy, Jacinda Wilder, you know, we had them all, you know, there, and they haven't come back because they just felt it really wasn't worth it. But it was so fascinating. At that point, there was a completely different cohort who was sort of the front runners of indie, and things have changed now. And I was looking at their business models, and they're all just getting on with it. And I do think this sometimes, you know, should I just get on with it and disappear? And then I'm like, no, I love talking to you guys. I love researching all these things about the market and hopefully continuing to provide value. So anyway, Pamela Chavez says, this was so interesting. Thanks for sharing. So funny that the University of Chihuahua was at the book fair. That's my hometown, which is cool. I just love it. I think Chihuahua is such a great word. Tori Element says, this is my extracurricular activity while listening to the Creative Pen podcast, and sent a picture of lifting weights in the gym. And hello to all you gym bunnies listening while exercising or walking or out there doing stuff. Thank you so much. Lisa M. Lilly is not at the gym. She sent a picture of her foot in a cast, listening to the Creative Pen share insights from the London Book Fair as I rest after practicing with crutches. It's hard work getting around with a broken foot. Oh, Lisa, I hope you get well soon. And Zoe Sadler says, enjoying illustrating colourful butterflies for my new picture book while listening to the Creative Pen podcast. Now my Monday morning ritual. And Zoe, I actually checked out Zoe's books, Zoe Sadler, S-A-D-L-E-R, and they are gorgeous, really beautiful, Zoe, and I've put them on my list for when my niece is a little bit older. She's a bit too young for them yet, but just gorgeous. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Koro Writing Life, and I will play a word from them in a minute. Thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Charisse Lou, I think that's how you say it. Sorry, Charisse. Gillian Duff, Lab Rat, Holly Wharton of the Business Mindset podcast, and thanks to Marion Hill for upping his pledge. So I really do appreciate the support on Patreon. Like, your tweets and emails demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I sent out a couple of days ago as this goes out on Monday. And you'll have that on the private feed if you are a supporter. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thank you. Here's a word from our sponsor. Then we'll get on with the interview.
Hey, Creative Pen listeners. I'm Christine Monroe, the senior manager of Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free self-publishing platform and a proud longtime sponsor of this podcast. Did you know that you can distribute your ebooks to Overdrive with one click? Right in your Kobo Writing Life dashboard, you'll get the full 50% royalty on the library price you set, which is exactly what you would receive if you had a direct Overdrive account, but without the hassle of managing two accounts. It's the very best royalty rate that you'll see anywhere, and that's because Kobo and Overdrive are sister companies, and we're working together to help library users get the best ebooks from amazing authors like you. We're rolling out Overdrive distribution to all KWL users in the next few months, but if you want access right now, email us at writinglife@kobo.com and we'll get you all set. We encourage authors to set a library price at 1.5 to 3 times higher than their ebook list price, and you'll get 50% of that price every time a library purchases your book. And then your fans can borrow your ebook for free on Overdrive's new app, Libby. That's L-I-B-B-Y. That's right, you get paid 50% and library users get to read for free. For more information about setting up a free Kobo Writing Life account, head to kobo.com/writinglife. Thanks so much, and I'll hand it back over to you, Joanna.
Today, I'm back with Joel Friedlander. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Joanna.
Great to have you back on the show. I think it's number 4 or maybe 5 on the show over the last 9 years.
Some things it's good to lose track of, I guess. But I'm really happy, and thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Let's just do a little introduction for those people who might not know you. So Joel Friedlander is an author, book designer, professional speaker, and blogger. He runs thebookdesigner.com, regularly voted in the top sites for writers, and has courses, templates, and many resources for authors. His most recent project, and what we're talking about today, is the Write Well, Writer's Journal, which I have a red copy of here.
Joel, I have a black one.
Yeah, black one. So this
I'm going to talk about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that would be great. And that's what we're talking about today. So I'm very excited about this. Those regular listeners will know that about a year ago, I flirted with the idea. I even met people about doing a journal. You have done a journal. So I'm excited. But why, for you personally, you've done so many books over the years. Why a journal and why now?
You know, one thing about those books, they all have words in them. And if you think about it, this is a book with no words yet. The words are latent, you might say. Mm. Well, I use journals and notebooks. I've used them for many years. I am not a journaler in that I don't sit and record scenes or what I did that day, but I still use them. For notes, for talking with clients, for developing ideas, drawing mind maps, whatever, recording conversations I'm having, because I realized a long time ago, you know, if I write it on a 3x5 card, you know, I'm going to lose that. And if it's in a journal, you're not going to lose it. So I love journals. I've been using them for many years. I have stacks. My wife has even bigger stacks. And, you know, the problem is, Joanna, I'm a professional book constructor in a sense, you know, and many of these journals really are, some of them are lovely and many of them are very irritating, and which is a problem when you have a little perfectionist streak. And, you know, I have thought for a long time, you know, I could do that better because I know how to put books together. And so this year, I've really been more interested, Joanna, in doing more personal projects because I've been doing other people's projects for so long. I'm really interested in working on my own projects. And this is a project I knew that would bring me a lot of joy as well as help other people. So it doesn't get any better than that.
So, I love it.
I totally agree that, you know, I understand why you went into and then out of this project, because it's actually quite daunting. And even though I've made hundreds of books over the years, and I know all about book binding and papers and adhesives and all that stuff, this project stumped me. And it took me, I thought it was going to take about 6 weeks, and it took over a year to put together the materials, the way of manufacturing, the right bender. And it was very, very challenging. But very pleased with the outcome.
Yeah, so we're going to get into the challenges because I definitely think they are underestimated. But let's first talk about the features that were important to you when you went into this. So like you said, I can do it better. So what are the features? For example, having been down this path, it's interesting. The cover you sent me, this, I would say Oxblood, is it an Oxblood?
Cranberry, we call it.
Okay, Cranberry.
Cranberry.
I'm a thriller writer. I prefer Oxblood. But it's a dark red to those who are not watching the video. So if you're on audio only, I've got the kind of cranberry. And it's got these rounded corners, which I know are impressive. What were some of the other things? It's got a ribbon. I've got the little ribbon here. So what are the other features that were important to you and that impacted the design process the most? So what are things that people take for granted that are really hard?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of elements that come into creating physical products. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And books are no different. A book is a physical product. And a journal is even more so because, you know, this isn't restricted to bookstores. Particularly, you can sell them anywhere, but there are a lot of manufacturing demands and financial demands to doing it. But what I was looking to do was to correct some of the errors or irritations that I had using other journals. Like, for instance, the journal that won't lay flat. Mm. That was my number one goal. And you can see from this journal here, for those who are watching this, that these journals will open flat anywhere you open it in the book. And, you know, if you have one that's like a hardcover journal, you may have experienced, you know, leaning your elbow on one side so you could write on the other side. Well, I just found that is wrong. Your journal should be a pleasure to use and it should lay flat so you can write in it easily. The rounded corners were really important to me because these are very mobile. People carry their journals with them. They stick them in their purse or their briefcase or even in their pocket or their backpack. And so the square corners tend to get banged very easily and they get dog-eared and they fold over. I don't like that. So the solution to that is the round corner, and that does take special finishing at the printer. The paper obviously was super important that it be able to absorb all kinds of writing instruments well. The way the interior was laid out in mine, you can tell that I'm a minimalist because I created this journal specifically for writers, not for sketch artists or bullet journal planners or productivity people. No, this is just a canvas for writers to write, and it was optimized for that. So there's no interruptions, it's just lines on the page. Now, Joanna, I know you like the blank page. And my first go around, I thought lines or rules, as we call them in printing, would be important. Mm. So the lay flat binding, the round corners, the good paper, the minimalist interior, the ribbon you have to have. If you don't have a ribbon, it's really hard to sell it as a journal. Mm. You know, whether you use the place marker or not, because a lot of people just stick pieces of paper, business cards, whatever in there. But if it doesn't look like a journal without the ribbon,
that's interesting.
Isn't critical it, visual cue.
Yeah. And hasn't it got more pages in?
Well, also, most of the journals sold in the U.S. run between 160 and 192 pages. And one of my problems with that is you have to keep replacing them. And so these journals, Wrightwell journals, have 240 pages, substantially larger, and they won't need to be replaced as often. I also was very irritated over the years by trying to find things in my journal. Mm. You know, maybe I wrote down an idea for, and this is actually true, an idea for a bean dip recipe. You know, and one day I went to try and find it, and I must have spent 15 minutes just leafing. Is so irritating. So these journals actually have page numbers on pages. And then at the end, there's an index page where you can actually kind of create a little index to what you've written and you can find it right away. I thought that was a pretty good innovation. And lastly, I would say many of the journals I've bought tend to be kind of narrow. And I don't know if manufacturers make them that way so they're easier to fit in your purse or pocket, but I find them a bit claustrophobic. Because I just get to the end of the line too soon. So I intentionally made these journals wider than the normal ones. And I'm very, very happy with the results. So those are some of the product innovations that I put into Wrightwell journals And I believe they're kind of unique. I don't know of another journal on the market that has these kind of qualities.
Mm.
And I will say, Joanna, all the feedback I'm getting is extremely positive.
Yes, we should say again, if people aren't on the video, that it's about A5. Is it A5 size? Because we haven't really said what
exactly.
Size it is. Yeah. So it's A5. I like the A5.
Within a thousandth. You know, we don't use A5 in the U.S., so it's an inch measurement, but yes, it's basically exactly A5.
Yeah, but it's what I like that size too, because I don't want an A4 journal that feels like school, and I don't want I have some of those tiny journals, like I've got some on my desk here, but they're too small, and they, you know, you can't, like you say, you can't get many words on the page. I think this is the most similar to a Luke term. Have you seen the Luke term?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, which also
it came out in the U.S. When I was about 3/4 of the way through my product development. Mm. And the Lectern is the closest I've seen to what I put together. It was actually kind of freaky because I thought, wow, they're doing the things that I'm doing. And they're very nice journals, Lectern.
They are. Yeah. So it's so just so people know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so brilliant. So let's just go into it a bit more. So the lie flat, because I went in when I had this conversation with a publisher that I went in to see, and the first thing I said was, it has to lie flat. And they just kind of looked at me like, oh my goodness, what are you talking about? So can you explain a bit more about the types of binding and why this is such a big deal and how you got over that with the binding that you use?
Yeah, well, this is and you also had asked me earlier about cost factors involved in producing these. And by far on this journal, the binding is the biggest cost factor to get that real lay flat binding. Okay, so, you know, there are many ways to bind books. And part of the reason it took me so long to develop this, I'd never actually done a book with a flexible cover. Because I really love that flexible feeling. It just feels luscious to me and rich, and I just really like it. So when I first started talking about this, I was talking to Robin Cutler, who you may know, who runs Ingram Spark. Mm. She is the manager of Ingram Spark, and she said, oh, that's great, Joel. Do them at Ingram Spark, and I'll help you out. And I said, geez, Robin, I would love to do that, but I can't. Mm. You can't POD these books because print-on-demand books use what's called a perfect binding, where all the ends of the pages are glued to the cover. You know, they're chopped off and then glued to the cover. Now, that is, you know, and you'll notice on your print-on-demand books, the spine is kind of tight. So they won't open fully. And they won't lay flat. And if you try to do that, you're going to break the spine. And you do stand the risk at that point of pages starting to fall out. That's not a good solution. So, yeah, this binding is called a soft side case binding. And the cover material is actually glued to a piece of paper that runs throughout the whole back spine of the book. And that's what the book block is glued to. And in this case, the pages are all sewn into the binding, so they can never come out. You would have to physically tear the book apart to make them come out because, you know, and if you open it fully, you'll see little threads, the marks of little threads in the book. So it's done on a case binding machine, which is what's used for doing hardcover books. But instead of a board case that's hard, this uses this kind of custom material I had made. another cost factor, because I couldn't find the exact thing I wanted, so I had to have it custom done. You know, with this kind of grain and the soft finish and the flexibility. So the binding on these journals is really, really good. And like I say, you can fold them all different kinds of ways, and they're never going to come apart. So the binding, but doing that is a lot more expensive than perfect binding, which is a totally automated process where they chop the books, they glue things on, they bring a knife down and trim them. That's it. You're finished. That could be done very inexpensively. But if you want a true lay flat binding, it does cost money. And that's one of the reasons why the journals have the retail price they do. Here in the U.S., they retail for $22.
Mm. Well, I think that's really interesting because I generally buy Luke Terms or Moleskins, and they do. I mean, I think they retail here in the UK for around £12, £15, which would be similar price to a $22. And a lot of people say, oh, that's so expensive, but it's not. And I think what you're saying is so interesting because I have behind me in my, you can't see them, but I've got shelves and shelves of journals as well. And it's... Uh-huh. The journal is emotional. It's an emotional product. I mean, it, for me, like, of course, we all love books in print and ebook and audio, whatever, but it's a taking approach. Reading a book is a taking approach, and the product, you take from the product. But the journal, you emotionally are involved with it, and what you write in it becomes part of your life. It's so important. So what you're saying, I love the fact that you got a custom material because it does feel really nice. It's very, very, it's hard to describe. How would you describe it? Because it's not leather. It's got some kind of...
It's got a grain to it.
Yes, it's got a grain, but it's not plasticky. That's important. It's not plasticky.
Type of grain. And, you know, when you make these materials, and this is something you find out that's actually kind of cool when you start doing, talking to manufacturers, material suppliers, you know, you don't usually have to settle for just what they had. You can actually create something that doesn't exist. And so by combining the kind of grain, the weight of the cover, the color, and the actual finish on it, this very soft finish that's not high gloss and it's not dead matte, it's kind of somewhere in between, you can create something unique. And the word I use for this experience is it's intimate. People are very intimate with their journals because you're writing sometimes stuff that nobody else will ever see. A lot of people use journals. Look, I'm in Northern California. It's the Human Potential Movement headquarters here. I mean, people at workshops and meditations and retreats, and they're doing like psychological processing by writing stuff. It's very sensitive material. And so that sense of intimacy and, you know, the personal connection you have with the object that you're expressing yourself in, I think is really crucial to what I was trying to achieve with this journal.
Yeah. So let's talk about the money in a couple of ways. So first of all, when I went down this process, the actual reason I stopped is because in the UK, blank journals, and I like blank journals, are taxed like they're taxed as stationery rather than books. And in Britain, we have VAT, like a sales tax on stationery that we don't have on print books. And there's a certain percentage of text that you have to have something classified as a book so that the sales tax is different. And I would have had to go through all these different hoops to do stationery. So I wondered, what was that like in the US? Did you find that it became a different product, that you're now a stationer?
No, it's actually totally different. It's a non-issue in the United States. And part of the reason for that is because sales taxes are all locally administered. In other words, we have no national sales tax in the U.S. We have some states have a sales tax. Some counties have a sales tax, which is added to the state sales tax. Some places, like where I'm sitting, also have a city sales tax. So we have a City of San Rafael, County of Marin, State of California, add them all up. When you go into a shop down the street here, you're going to pay about 7.5% sales tax. But you're going to pay that on anything. Hot tubs, cars, journals. There's no discrimination about the kind of product you're buying. It's a flat tax on anything you buy at retail. And the retailer has to collect the tax and then report it and pay it to the appropriate government. But it's much simpler. There's no discrimination between different types of products, you know, at this level. So whether I'm a stationer or a bookmaker,
it doesn't make any difference. And it's interesting because, of course, and again, most authors who are listening don't have to worry about sales tax because usually we use Amazon KDP, Kobo, Apple. They deal with that and we just get the money later. Right. But what we're talking about here is not using print on demand. So so tell us, how did you do this practically with a print run? How are you selling them? And then how will you continue to sell them in terms of distribution?
Just like I that's all really interesting, but I would like to point out one thing, Joanna, and that is that the vast majority of print books sold in the United States, and I'd reckon it's probably the same in the UK, are offset printed books. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of printed books, even though in the indie publishing community, a print book is almost defined as a POD product. I remember when Guy Kawasaki came out with his book, Ape, author, publisher, entrepreneur. You remember that a few mm-hmm. years ago? He didn't have anything in there about books printed offset. And I actually complained to him about that. I said, Guy, you know, you're putting this book out here, but you're ignoring most of the books printed. And the fact is that many self-publishers don't know this, but there's a long tradition, very active tradition of self-publishers publishing print books through offset printing distribution and actually getting to that whole system. So basically, you have to contract with a manufacturer. And part of my challenge with the journals was finding a manufacturer who could do what it was I was trying to do. I spoke to at least 36 printers, I would say, over the course of time. Rather frustrating because some of them would say they could do it, but then they couldn't. So you have to vet your supplier. You do have to have capital because you have to pay everything up front. Like in print on demand, we don't pay anything. Basically, you know, over at Ingram, you might have to pay to upload your files. But when they print the books, they don't come and ask you for the money. They deduct the money from the cost that the buyer is paying. So, yes, the book printers will not ship your books without having a complete payment for the entire print run in their hands before they kick those books off the shipping dock. They won't start your project without having like a third to a half of the anticipated expense. And, you know, but I do print books for clients all the time. And so this is not really that esoteric. I mean, obviously, my journal is an unusual product. But, you know, as far as having a print book, your print runs are going to start at about 500 copies. Because under that, it doesn't really make financial sense. You're going to be paying too high a cost. Now, once you hit about 500 or 1,000 copies, and my guideline for authors usually is that I say to them, if you can tell me for sure that you could sell like 500 books in the next 6 months, I'm going to tell you, go get them printed because they're going to cost you half as much mm-hmm. as what the print-on-demand vendor is charging you. Now, print-on-demand is very convenient. But, you know, once you understand how this whole print distribute retail system works, then it's not really that hard to get into it. Now, for my purposes, my journal ended up creeping up in cost as the production went along. I started off with a really great estimate. Man, I was excited. Wow, I'm going to make money on this project. And, you know, actually the cost kept creeping up. So I got to the point where they're profitable. And I'm not complaining about the profit, but if you want to distribute the books, in other words, if I want to have a lot of retailers selling them, then I have to have a pretty low unit cost compared to my retail price. And the reason for that is that everybody in the distribution chain has to make a profit. So they add something to your cost. So let's say I have a book that sells for $10 retail. You know, my distributor may only pay me $3 for that book. That's a 70% discount. Mm-hmm. $3.50 maybe, a 65% discount. So from that $3.50 on my $10 book, I have to pay for the manufacturing of the books, the shipping of the books, and hopefully to have any profit left over. So this is really, this is the subject of many consultations I have with people, figuring out this whole matrix between the kind of book you're producing and your marketing. Because the marketing is what should influence that production, not the author's idea of what wonderful thing I want to create. Your question, Joanna.
Yeah. So, well, just on that, you had this great blog post about the impossible book project, and that related to this sort of thing. It's like, oh, I want gold leaf and embossing and stamping and my thing on the back and a hard cover with a, you know, and it's like all of those things add cost in the same way that like adding the rounded corners adds a surprising cost, right? So all of these decisions make a difference. But the question, coming back to the question, was, so how are you selling them? Is it all pre-orders for the print run, or are you going to have them shipped to Amazon and do Amazon, you know, retail, or how are you going to do that?
I am not selling on Amazon right now, and I am not retailing at the moment. I'm doing all direct selling, and that's because the developing the journal was expensive. And I put in a year of work, and you know, I've got stacks and stacks of samples here and journals and prototypes. And at the cost that I'm paying now for the journals, I decided to start off this whole enterprise by direct selling. And that's also partly, you asked me at the beginning, why did I do this? You know, but I looked at my website and my email list, and I said, wait a second, I have tens of thousands of writers. And, you know, I knew that 8 years ago, but for some reason the light bulb went off and I thought, wow, this is a perfect something I'd love to do. And then I know my readers would love to buy because who doesn't want a really nice writer's journal if you're a writer? And what surprised me is, yeah, so I did do a pre-sale, and I did it explicitly to raise the money to pay the second half of the printer's invoice, because, you know, that makes sense. I'm doing this to put these into the hands of writers. So if I can offer you a discount on a pre-sale, you know, we did fairly well. We sold several hundred journals on the pre-sale, collected all the money I needed to pay that second invoice from the printer. It all worked out great. But now I'm only doing direct sales. But, you know, this is just the beginning of this product line. I, you know, the whole idea going into it wasn't just to create a journal, but it was to take these innovations. And for instance, the next set I'm working on will be have many of these same innovations, but they'll be less expensive and because they'll have paperback covers. Now, I would like to talk about the covers just for a second.
Yeah, because it
illustrates the kind of thing you can do when you control the whole production process. Now, it used to be in the old days when all books were offset printed that we frequently did split runs. So a split run would be we would print, let's say, 2,000 books, the interior, the book block, and then we would bind up 1,500 as paperbacks and then bind up the other 500 as hardcovers, because that really is not very expensive to do, surprisingly, if you compare it to the price you can demand for a hardcover book, just like $10 higher than a paperback book. Yeah. But it's only the cost factor is only about an extra dollar or two. So it really is very cost effective. Now, so I took the same approach. I said, well, I could do a journal. And when I talked to the people supplying the cover material, I said, you know, what's the minimum quantity to produce this custom material? And when they told me, I realized I could do the same thing on these journals. And that's why I ended up with two colors, because I thought, well, I'll sell more if I can give people a choice. Right. Some people like black. Some people don't. So we did a split run. We printed 1,000 journals, and then we split them between the cranberry covers or oxblood, you thriller people, and black covers. And that gave me, in essence, two products for the price of one. And I'm going to do the same thing on the paperbacks, because we're going to do like three or four different designs. But all the interiors will be printed at once, and then they'll just be bound up in the different covers. So in effect, I'll do one print run, but I'll have four different products.
It's so interesting, because this is such a different world to the kind of print-on-demand model that most people listening will be using. And although the downside is, yes, you have to pay up front and do all this design work, what you're now doing is not just stopping. Basically, the one I have here is more of a prototype, in a way that you're going to be doing a lot more products. But that's really interesting to me. Also, you say a paperback cover. This is a soft. So is this called a soft cover? Because it's not hardback. It's
No, soft. It's not hard. But what I'm talking about is actual, like a paperback book. has paper that's been printed, right? Like all your books on your shelf are paperbacks. They have printed paper covers that are wrapped on the interior. In this case, I'm using this special material, you know, in the binding. Mm. But I could have also just taken paper, just like your covers, and printed them and wrapped them in that and had everything else the same.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, less expensive because this cover material is a premium priced product.
I see. It's so interesting. And I wanted to ask you about the little insert that comes with it, which is the Writewell story. And it's how to free write. It's not, but it's got information on the what the book is like for people on the video. And then it's an A4 that's folded, and it's got a little letter from you, including your signature. And it's very personal, and it talks about free writing, but it also tells you about the product. Now, you are a marketing genius. So you're very good at marketing.
I took that idea straight from Moleskine.
Ah, okay. But you made it very personal.
My own version. Mm. You know, what I found interesting, John, was I was looking at the packaging on Moleskine, and, you know, they come shrink-wrapped, which is good, and a product like this should be shrink-wrapped because the customer wants to buy it and cut that open. It's really important, and you know it's pristine. And it's also good because even if you don't open those for a year, when you undo the shrink wrap, they're going to be like they just came from the printer. Mm-hmm. So really important, if you're doing print books, I recommend shrink wrapping them in bundles, which is less expensive. And it's just to maintain the integrity of the book. So the question again, sorry.
Was back on the insert.
So here's what's interesting. I was looking at the Moleskines, and, you know, they have the wrap on the book and then a shrink wrapped, and it tells you what kind of Moleskine. You flip it over and they tell you the size. And then the only thing that it says on there, it says inside the Moleskine story. Mm. I found that very interesting from a marketing point of view. Was somebody clamoring for the Moleskine story? Was that a big demand? That's the only pull they had. But you know, Joanna, we talked about this before. The power of story itself is incredible. And it's stories that really sell things. You know, if you get hooked into the story, and that's why I wanted to tell a little bit the story of creating the journals and how the features that we were talking about solve problems. And then I put in, that's actually a little mini course on free writing. It's from a book I'm going to be publishing later this year, in fact. And, you know, all of the free writing I've done has been done in journals like that. So it's a close personal connection for me. And I thought that would really come through. I added my signature. I use it in many of my emails. And I really wanted to make it a personal communication between me and whoever is buying that journal. So they would see what I had done and why I did it that way. And, you know, they're also going to get a little mini course in there because that little mini course really works, by the way. It's
yes. good content. It is good content. And it's interesting because it reminded me that the reason I started writing in Moleskines back when I was like 15 was because of Bruce Chatwin, who wrote In Patagonia and Songlines. And a lot, you know, he was a travel writer who tragically died, back in the 80s. But the fact that he used Moleskines made me want to use Moleskines, and it connected an empty journal with a writer. And that's what I really appreciate this. I think this is genius. But we should just now we've mentioned it, just tell people what is free writing so they know what that is. I have talked about it before, but just explain it.
Well, free writing is a great practice. And just briefly, I mean, when you free write, you have a prompt and you have a timer. And the instruction is when the timer goes off, you start writing to the prompt. And like a very simple prompt might be something like, I remember. It's one of my favorites. And so you're dedicated to writing as fast as you possibly can for the assigned period of time. It could be 1 minute, 10 minutes, whatever. It doesn't matter. And the idea is to never take your pen off the page. You can't stop. You can't try to find the right word. What you're attempting to do is to write faster than you can ideate your thought, you know, your ideas. And it's a brilliant practice for writers. And I still use free writing sometimes just as a warm-up. The other day I was I had some writing to do, and I decided to do a little free writing warm-up, and I did an alphabetical free write. This is without a prompt. Just write down all the letters in the alphabet, and then you start free writing, and each word has to start with the next letter of the alphabet. Now, what this does is it completely defeats your logical mind. It defeats the grammar you have embedded in your language brain, and it allows other things to come out. And, you know, my free writing teacher, Suzanne Murray, used to always say to us, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. And I find that to be very true. And it's just astonishing the kind of things that you can come in contact with from within yourself in a free writing session. Is it UK? Very surprised.
Yes, I agree. And I definitely think it's great. And I just thought it was fantastic that you had it with the journal. It's almost a bit about you, but a bit about how you could use the journal. So that's fantastic. So I wanted to, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to just ask you, okay, we've given lots of tips, but if people are intending to do this kind of special print project, like you mentioned, doing a project for a personal project for joy reasons. But obviously,
I'm an old guy, so I may get it.
Is there anything else that people should think about?
I think workbooks are the first step for many indie authors, because if you have a nonfiction book, you know, you can have two books to sell instead of one very easily by creating a workbook that will really help people and lead them through the process that you're describing, whatever it is. Mm. So a workbook really kind of has to be printed. It's very hard to use a workbook that is just digital, like a PDF or something. So that's the way a lot of authors end up going into print. And I've done a lot of workbooks for my clients, but you know, you do have to have some capital or the ability to raise it. You don't have to have it yourself, but you can do a Kickstarter and really justify your project. Sometimes people have actually taken in investors. That's usually a family member.
I was going to say, yeah.
We call them investors, though. And, you know, you have to have some concept of what's going to happen all the way down. You have to work it out in advance, Joanna, so you know exactly what's going to happen. You know, who's going to print them, what it's going to cost, how you're going to ship them, who's going to store them, how are you going to fulfill orders. Like in my case, I'm not using Amazon. So I have a fulfillment house, and all these journals were not shipped to my garage. I don't want them here. They were shipped to the fulfillment house, and all the orders go to them, and there's a software integration on the sales page, so they just get the orders and ship them automatically. You have to work out what the cost for that is. Mm-hmm. How are you going to do that? Does that fit in with your profit calculations? So, I mean, it really probably would be best to talk to somebody who's walked that path already, or a professional in the print professional of some kind, to really put it all together in a line for you so you actually understand. Before you ever spend a dollar, you understand what it is that you're doing and how it's going to work. How are you going to fulfill the orders, et cetera. Mm. Now, for most people, selling on Amazon is probably a really good idea. I tell all my clients that we don't want to deal with returns, missed shipments, damaged books, all of those things that happen when you start shipping physical products around.
Yeah. And I think to me, that was the big red flag in the end. It was, oh, to do this, I will end up probably not even making any money. And I didn't want to do what, you know, you're an expert at this. You've been doing this for many years, like with print products. So yeah. I'm still excited about it in a way, but you've really backed up my decision not to do this. But it's fascinating. What is also fascinating is you started in print specialization. And then, of course, you and I met way back 2009-ish. when the indie space was really taking off and digital became the thing. And now this is not going back, but it's going forward. People want beautiful print more. So I'm really interested, what are your thoughts on the way that the digital space is changing and beautiful print is kind of resurgent?
Yeah, the revenge of print, I guess we could call it. Well, some of it's perception, Joanna, and some of it is reality. For instance, if you're an indie author, your perception does not include, and we talked about this, it doesn't include all the books that are being printed on huge printing presses and bound and shipped all over the world. That is the standard, right? Mm-hmm. In the indie author community, I mean, so much has changed. Like, think of all the formats we can publish in now. The fact that indie authors can publish paperbacks, hardcover books through print on demand, they can do audiobooks. I mean, nobody could do that 5 to 10 years ago. It just wasn't happening. And so you can reach a larger audience. A lot of people have gotten really learned publishing, people like you who have really studied it and understand how books are made and marketed are starting to go more into small presses. I know that's familiar to you. But even people who just got bit by the bug and actually started a real small press on a traditional model where they're buying in books and publishing them for other authors. I think that makes a lot of sense. There are cooperatives. Also, the access to the resources you need to publish. 5 years ago or 8 years ago, if somebody said, well, how can I find an editor? That was like almost a make or break kind of type of thing. I mean, it's very hard to find a book editor. Now we got marketplaces like Readsy and BiblioCrunch and these people who will match you up. It's much easier. And also, another thing that's changed is the acceptance of self-publishing or indie publishing. I mean, I write a column now for Publishers Weekly. That's the Bible of the printing publishing industry in the United States. And they have a whole section now just devoted to indie publishing. And, there's no bigger sign of acceptance that I could think of. And we see our titles on bestseller lists mixed in with all the books from major publishers. So it's really changed. I think that the print books, I mean, look at the beautiful book that Orna Ross did. I'm sure that was quite a project. I've done things like that. It's not exactly simple. But I think that the print book universe offers indie authors just a whole multitude of products and formats and things that you can't do in print on demand. In all of those genres where ebooks really aren't that big a factor, like if you're not a romance or a sci-fi or a thriller writer, you really have to look at your publishing business a little differently because, for those people, it makes sense to go digital, keep your costs low, learn about publishing by going straight to digital and worry about the whole print universe later, once you already know what you're doing. So I don't, unless you have a project that absolutely has to be a print project or an offset project. And certainly print on demand has expanded a lot. I'm doing a project for an author now that's a 2-volume hardcover jacketed reference books that are about 800 pages each. Obviously, this is from a religious library in Mexico, and that all the buyers are going to be institutional buyers. So the retail price really doesn't matter that much. The set may end up going for $150, but, they're all going to be bought by librarians, basically, or religious institutions. So in that kind of market, the whole calculation of the marketing and the production that I was talking about before to make sure you're doing the right book for your market changes tremendously when you have a project like that. So, and this is being self-published. So books are unique. There's so many different kinds. People often ask me my opinion about this. And I always say to them, well, you want to know what you should do with that book. Let me see that book and tell me what the plan is. Some books maybe should be with traditional publishers. I'm not against traditional publishing. That's, 99% of the books on my bookshelf were produced by professionals in a publishing company. You know, we can't lose sight of that. And if you, if your name is, Barack Obama, you should be with a traditional publisher because they're going to be able to put your book in thousands of bookstores, put you on mass media. But, you know, there are other costs come with that. Other books you profitably do yourself. So it's a really a book by book decision to me. And then looking to see how we can get that production marketing mix right. So we're producing the right book, pleasing readers and making a profit at the same time.
Mm. And I don't think Barack Obama's listening to the show, but, you know, you never know. that would be awesome. But so it's all fantastic. I've got the journal here. Everyone can go and check that out. So where can they check out where the journal is? And also, where can people find you online?
Well, my home online is my blog at thebookdesigner.com. That's thebookdesigner.com. And you can access all of my stuff there, including our great interior book templates that are just phenomenally popular, and all the other tools and resources we have for indie authors. And the journals live at writewelljournals.com. And right now we have two choices for you, black or cranberry. Coming soon, we'll have a whole much expanded line. But I'm really excited about the positive response I've gotten from people because they're just really loving using these journals. And that's why I did it. So, even though it's early days and we're just getting started, I kind of feel like I already won.
Yeah, I think we've all won, and I really appreciate you coming on today. So thanks so much for your time, Joel. That was great.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Joanna. Thanks for having me.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Joel today. And it's always interesting to consider these print-only products when we generally are so focused on digital. And I do think it's awesome for a personal limited edition project and something I will still be thinking about. Okay, so next week I have an interview on writing TV and film adaptations with David Nichols, best-selling author of One Day. And David talks about adapting his own work, but also classics like Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd. And we talk about his latest project, Melrose, which is an adaptation of five novels and a new TV series starring the lovely Benedict Cumberbatch. And it is a fascinating conversation. David is just, you know, I ask him all about like the behind the scenes, the realities of being a working screenwriter, and it's fascinating. And the Brits among you will know that David is pretty much a household name over here, so I was thrilled to interview him. So have a wonderful writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes, available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.